From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We all know the verdict in the George Zimmerman case. Not guilty in the death of Trayvon Martin. At least one congressman has told those unhappy with the outcome to just get over it. But a lot of people in the streets and at kitchen tables and churches this weekend weren't over it yet. And the president wasn't over it when he spoke on Friday about race in America. This hour on Point, the country and race after Trayvon Martin. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. What needs to be said? Done. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Lots of protests all over the country this weekend. Here's a little sound from Atlanta. Justice for Trayvon protests. What do we want? Justice. When do we want it? Now, at a protest in New York City on Saturday, organized by Reverend Al Sharpton's National Action Network, Trayvon Martin's mother, Sabrina Fulton, spoke to the crowd.
He had a drink and candy. So not only do I bow to you to do what I can for Trayvon Martin, I promise you I'm going to work hard for your children as well, because it's important.
In Miami, at a protest, Trayvon Martin's father, Tracy Martin, spoke to reporters about why people, he said, are attending these protests.
I think the people are just tired of senseless violence. And the people really want the world to know that our children's lives matter just as much as their children's lives. And I think that we can't change the Stand Your Ground law, but we can definitely do something to make amendments to it.
And on Friday, after days of protests, largely peaceful, and long conversations all over this country, the President of the United States, the first African-American president, delivered a very personal take on the acquittal of George Zimmerman in the shooting of Trayvon Martin and the state of race relations in this country from the White House briefing room.
When Trayvon Martin was first shot, I said that this could have been my son. Another way of saying that is, Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago. And when you think about why, in the African-American community at least, there's a lot of pain around what happened here, I think it's important to recognize that the African-American community is looking at this issue through a set of experiences. And a history that doesn't go away.
Let's dive in. This isn't over. Joining me now from New York is Touré, journalist, cultural critic, and co-host of the MSNBC show The Cycle, author of, among other books, Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness? What It Means to Be Black Now. Touré, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
With us from Washington, Brian Monroe, editor of CNNPolitics.com. Brian, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me again.
And from Chicago, Laura Washington, columnist at the Chicago Sun-Times. Laura Washington, thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here again.
Laura, your reaction to the president's speech on Friday first.
It was a very complex speech, which was completely apropos, given that it is a very complex issue. There's been a lot of debate in this country about whether or not the Trayvon Martin case is about race. It's about race. It's about crime. It's about the criminal justice system. It's about our legal system. It's about our perceptions of ourselves. And I think he wove all of those themes and those issues into that speech. And I think the big message was, this is not something that can be, you know, tossed off to a civil rights case or tossed off to, as you referred to earlier, comments about just getting over it. It's a very complicated issue, and it's one that we need to continue to not just have a conversation about, but to get serious about looking at policies, practices, and the way that we view ourselves going forward.
What did you hear the bottom line call as being in this speech, Laura? What was he asking for?
Yeah, I think it was very complicated, so I wouldn't say there was one bottom line, but the thing that I found most compelling was Barack Obama speaking from his own personal experiences and reflecting on that and making the case that many African-Americans have had those personal experiences, have had that history, and that we're not looking for sympathy, simply we're not looking for excuses, and he used the term very profoundly, excuses, but rather that we need to be aware of these experiences and put them into context. And I thought that was a very important message for America to hear, especially coming from our first black president.
Touré, Brian Monroe, I want to come straight to you, but first a little more of the president Friday in the White House briefing room.
There are very few African-American men in this country who haven't had the experience of being followed when they were shopping in a department store. That includes me. There are very, very few African-American men who haven't had the experience of walking across the street and hearing the locks click on the doors of cars. That happens to me, at least before I was a senator. There are very few African-Americans who haven't had the experience of getting on an elevator and a woman clutching her purse nervously and holding her breath until she had a chance to get off. That happens often.
Touré, this president has not talked a lot about race, but here he is doing it, and it's very Barack Obama, at least to my ear. This is far from rage. This is very considered, studied, even-keeled. He's saying, let's consider some context here, but he's not pointing at nothing. He's not saying nothing by any means, Touré.
Yes, I think that's correct. Although different than the Philadelphia speech where he played both sides and he said, well, I understand the grandmother who crosses the street because my grandmother does that even though she loves me to death.
His white grandmother.
Yes, exactly. Here he was very much speaking in the mode as a black man and not sort of moving out. There's no moment where he says, well, I feel for George Zimmerman. He's in a difficult situation as well. He's saying that young black men are not full citizens in this country because of Stand Your Ground, because of racial profiling, because of this history of bias, because of this difficult history. And, you know, that's one of those moments when he's being sort of nuanced and he's talking about slavery and segregation and lynching and these sort of things. But he doesn't actually come out and say it and nail it so that white people feel offended and attacked. But he sort of delicately says it and we know what he's talking about. You know, when he's talking about the difficulty of being a black man, and black women are included in it too, but so many of these things are really aimed at black men, it's a very powerful statement. I was extraordinarily proud of him in this moment because he wasn't sort of splitting the atom and saying, well, you know, it's equal on both sides.
Yep.
It's not equal on both sides. What black men are getting out of this deal as Americans because of profiling, because of Stand Your Ground, because of so many other things is a raw deal. We are not full citizens. We feel it. We know it. And he acknowledged that.
I want to look at those observations. Brian Monroe, I guess it is self-evident, but still amazing. No other president could have delivered this speech. No other president in our history.
Well, and looking at the timing of it, too, you know, he held off a week before saying anything publicly. He released that statement. But, you know, Friday afternoon when he came out, he actually gave this some thought. We reported that on Thursday is when he decided to do this, prepared it overnight, but walked into the briefing room without any notes, no teleprompter, and spoke from the heart. And you know, echoing Touré, you know, he did thread a needle. At first, he came out and said, the jury has spoken. The verdict is in.
Yep.
We have to live with it. But then he pivoted very quickly to saying, but here's the real deal, that me as an African-American male. And it's interesting, when this came down that Saturday night, I was sitting on my couch next to my 11-year-old son. And my son turned to me and said, what, Daddy? This doesn't make sense. He killed somebody. He killed Trayvon. Why isn't he going to jail? And that opened a conversation that we had to, you know, explain to him what was going on. And I'm sure that conversation happened across the country at many other households, African-American and white. But particularly in the African-American households, the things we have to tell our sons now, that we didn't think we had to do that anymore. We still have to do that.
Touré, you wrote about that over the weekend. You said the night he was elected, you held your 9-month-old son and thought, you're going to grow up in a new world. Yeah. A day ago, you thought differently.
Well, yeah. I mean, after the night that the verdict was announced was also very difficult for me emotionally, and I realized that my son's going to have to deal with a lot of the same stuff that I had to deal with, the lessons from my parents, that I'm sure Brian is passing on to his son about, you know, don't run in public if you don't have to. You know, keep your hands out of your pockets when you're walking through a store. All those little things that you can do to mitigate or mollify the potential of being suspected so that you have to manage the fearsomeness that others feel about you. But, you know, what the president did is, yes, he acknowledged this specific trial, and perhaps, you know, there was not enough evidence to convict George Zimmerman. We know that obviously Trayvon is dead, but in a stand your ground world where only one person is still here to speak about what happened, there's no direct evidence, no direct eyewitness to the final moment. So you don't fully know what happened. So, you know, he's not guilty, but that does not mean that he's innocent. But, you know, even if we can't say that this jury should have done something else, okay, given the jury instructions, given the evidence they had, this is not an isolated incident for us. This does not exist outside of this very long narrative where black bodies are destroyed, the justice system seems to shrug, and we are left to deal with the knowledge that black bodies are worth a little bit to a lot less in this country.
Laura, there's a lot to talk about here. This whole thing is not over, but for the moment, was this enough for the people in the streets who are demonstrating? Was this a strong enough statement from this president?
I think it is. I think he absolutely embraced race in a way that he has not before, and I think he was speaking for America. And I think it's important to remember that this is not just about black folks and getting validation of our pain, but rather this is America's burden. And he's speaking as the president of the United States, not just for African Americans. And I think it was important for him to talk about himself personally, because he's validating again the history here. This could have been me 35, 40 years ago. It could have been another black man 100 years ago. It's going to be another black man further. And this verdict, in many ways, validates that history will continue unless we find ways to stop it. And that was something that I think that people needed to hear.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the president, the country, and race after Trayvon Martin. Laura Washington is with us from the Chicago Sun-Times, Brian Monroe from CNNPolitics.com, Touré from MSNBC's The Cycle, author of Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness. You can join the conversation this hour. Where are we as a nation on race? Was the president right to step in on this, to get personal? That could have been me. How was his timing? Was it late? Was it just right? And has this president led us on race by words, by example? Did he get it right? We're making progress. We're not post-racial. He got very particular on the history of African Americans and the law and its application. Here he was on Friday.
The African American community is also knowledgeable that there is a history of racial disparities in the application of our criminal laws, everything from the death penalty to enforcement of our drug laws. And that ends up having an impact in terms of how people interpret the case.
And the former law professor, now president of the United States, brought up some hypotheticals.
For those who resist that idea that we should think about something like these stand your ground laws, I just ask people to consider, if Trayvon Martin was of age and armed, could he have stood his ground on that sidewalk? And do we actually think that he would have been justified in shooting Mr. Zimmerman, who had followed him in a car, because he felt threatened? And if the answer to that question is at least ambiguous, then it seems to me that we might want to examine those kinds of laws.
Touré, in New York, pick up the president's hypothetical there. Do we actually think if Trayvon Martin was of age and armed, could he have stood his ground on that sidewalk? Touré.
No, he could not have stood his ground on that sidewalk. I mean, physically, he could have done that. But then, of course, law enforcement would have come in and arrested him immediately.
But it does happen in Florida. They have the stand your ground law. And it's not only whites who exercise that very broad freedom.
Well, it's interesting you brought that up, because there are statistics that we know about all this. If a white person shoots a black person, then those killings are 34% of those killings are found justified. If a black person shoots a white person, then 3% of those killings
are
found
nationally
justified.
Or Florida? Stand your ground country.
I believe those are national numbers, and I don't really see any value in just sort of putting it just in Florida. I know that there's some new right-wing meme that blacks invoke stand your ground in Florida more often than whites. I cannot find that data. And the Daily Caller actually has numbers that suggest that there are more white people who invoke stand your ground than black people, 77-44. But, you know, I mean, we have a situation that is not new. This is not new to stand your ground. This has been going on for decades that black people are less able to protect ourselves. And so much of our criminal justice system and laws are built around the idea of white people being able to protect themselves from the criminal black man.
Brian Monroe, what's being worked out here? And the president wasn't in a lather. You know, he's always, even if as he's raising very difficult issues, he's calm, and by that calmness, kind of encouraging calmness, I guess. But yet, you know, he's saying, hey, let's look at stand your ground laws. Let's look, each of us, at the bias that we may still carry and try and wring it out of ourselves, he says. What do you see being worked out here in this, Brian?
Well, in some ways, he's trying to focus the country's attention, and particularly those who are most upset's attention, beyond just getting out in the streets and protesting and letting their voices be heard. And you saw the same thing with Eric Holder and his speeches to both the Delta Sigma Theta Incorporated here in D.C. and to the NAACP in Florida, that the activity, if they want to make change, it's got to be more focused on changing laws. And particularly, remember, standing your ground is nothing but an extension of the self-defense laws in Florida and 20-some other states that were, you know, the Castle Doctrine, where if someone entered your home, you could defend yourself. Standing your ground extends that out to anywhere around your property, in the streets, basically anywhere you want to be. And that, you know, and the president in his remarks said that that's problematic. We even had John McCain come out this weekend and say basically the same thing, that those laws need to be looked at. But what's really fascinating is we did a piece on this following Friday's remarks, looking at what people are saying and the reaction. And yes, there were people who were very supportive and positive of the president's remarks, but there was as many, if not more, vocally angry, you know, sort of the get over it. Yeah, we know you, you get eyeballed in the store. We know women cross the street. We know all that stuff. So get over it. And, you know, and it was pretty heated and pretty vehement. Even some people who were saying, well, you know, why are you guys making such a big deal out of this one case of a black child being shot?
I thought the get over it.
There's so many thousands of black on black crime. So the root.com looked at that and said, well, actually, you have more likely chance to be shot by a white person than you do by a black person, black or white. You have twice as much of a chance to be forcibly raped, to be robbed, to be assaulted, to be burglared by whites than by blacks. And those were the facts of the numbers. And look, those don't seem to get in the argument.
Brian's absolutely right. Let me just say one thing. Yep. That the Stand Your Ground laws, the Castle Doctrine, I don't have a problem with, but the Stand Your Ground law, which extends it into the public square,
you don't have to retreat if you feel threatened.
Exactly. Ultimately, it's a marketing tool for the NRA to sell more guns and feel more comfortable owning a gun and shooting somebody, and you won't go to jail because Stand Your Ground will be there for you.
But you saw David Frum over the weekend tweeting, you know, hey, why isn't the NRA saying Trayvon would have been fine if only he would have been packing? Let's hold these. I want to come back to a lot of this. Tapo is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Tapo, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to touch on that a little bit more, too. I just happen to be a person of mixed race living in Iowa.
Okay.
And so it affords me a lot of opportunities, and I hate to say it, but like a lot of times it is based on race. But I have a lot of friends on both spectrums, and you definitely see that within the public eye here. My Caucasian friends are very much, you know, get over it. It's over it. It happened. That's sad. But there's nothing we can do. And almost all of my African American and black friends take it very personally. They take it as an affront that, it really made it real to them that race is something that will always be a negative for them, and that they're worth less, I guess, is how they see it from just talking with certain friends. And I don't know if it's because I have such strong friends on both sides that I do feel like I fall somewhere in the middle. I see both of them, but it is definitely something that is almost touchable here.
And you hear it, Tapo, when your white friends say, get over it, what exactly do you think they're saying? Are they saying, look, you will be better off not framing things in racial terms? Let's just stop doing that and see how that works? Do they think that's realistic?
I don't want to make it sound like they are bad people or it's racist on an issue for them.
Absolutely.
But I do think that they see it, they just don't hold the same value, is what I can say, for the fact that race played a part in this, because it is like, it's so there. It's something that's not covered in a shroud of haze. It's something that it made it very real to African Americans, and they're not saying, hey, you do cost less, and hey, it is not a big deal. They're saying, that's a shame that it happened. I hope that it wouldn't happen again, but it just doesn't carry the same weight.
So kind of move on without the sense of the weight behind it. Tapu, I appreciate your call. Laura Washington, you're in Chicago. You've got a very big African-American population there. How does the get over it response resonate in your neck of the woods, Laura?
Of course, people reject that here, and I think, but I understand the sentiment coming from white folks, because they do not share these experiences. I have these conversations with friends and colleagues all the time. They do not go into department stores and follow. They do not get stopped by police for no reason simply because of their race. So it's very difficult for them to relate to this. And then they see the statistics, they interpret certain statistics that they see, that African Americans are committing most of the crime, that African Americans are most of the folks that are in prison. So the perception is, well, they must be there for a reason. They must be, if a caller says, worth less. I think that's why it was so important for the president to stand up and say, I've had this experience. Barack Obama, the Harvard law grad, the law professor, the very smart guy, the president of the United States has had these same experiences, and I've been having them, as he said, you know, I was having them up until the time I was elected a U.S. senator in Chicago, and every Chicagoan and every other black man can relate to that. And even he would say that he feels worthless. Well, there's got to be something wrong with our society, with our culture, if that kind of condition exists.
Lord, what about...
It's very important for him to say that, because he's a great smart guy, so you know, he's not a criminal. He's not.
Right.
He hasn't been in prison. So what's wrong with this picture?
Credibility there. We invited Michael Nutter on, mayor of Philadelphia. He was writing last week in Time magazine saying, you know, why is it that African-American males are so disproportionately both the victims and perpetrators of violence? Saying that in Philadelphia, you know, 75% of homicide victims are black men, 80% arrested for homicide are black men. You know, so many killed every day, more than a new town every day around this country. Many of them are black men by black men. I mean, he's saying that's an issue. Is that beside the point here, Laura? In Washington, you've got plenty of this violence. I mean, in Chicago, I should say.
No, I think that that's why we're having this conversation.
Yeah.
It cannot be beside the point. It cannot, because you will continue to have people being profiled, you will continue to have African-American families afraid for their children to walk the streets. And that's just not acceptable.
Tom, I think part of what you're referring to here and then part of what Laura is touching on is this sort of feedback loop that happens, that we are expected to be criminal, ergo we are over-policed and thus over-convicted, over-prosecuted, over-convicted, over-sentenced, which creates more of a perception that we are more criminal and thus we should be profiled even more. And it just sort of feeds on itself, and it creates these numbers that people can say, well, look at these huge numbers that, of course, we should. When we look a little further, we see that blacks and whites commit crimes at very similar rates, especially drug crimes, which really are the largest driver of the mass incarceration situation we have now. Blacks and whites use and sell drugs at extremely similar rates, nowhere near the disproportionate arrest rate and conviction rate that we have. So, I mean, the profiling is the beginning of the river that creates the problem that leads to people being able to say, well, look at them. They're inherently criminal. But you started out with the perception that we were inherently criminal.
I mean, to be fair to Mayor Nutter in Philadelphia, he's teamed up with Mayor Mitch Landrieu down in New Orleans. They've got this group, Cities United. He wants to do more in urban areas to sort of get people off of that path, off of that track. It's not like he's just saying, hey, look here, that's it. He wants to do something about it.
Hey, I'm not criticizing Mayor Nutter. I'm sure he is absolutely aware of the feedback loop that I'm talking about, and I'm sure that he is part of the majority of the black community, which is far more in favor of gun control than the white community, even after Sandy Hook, when the white community was so loudly saying, we need gun control. You weren't even close to the numbers that black people routinely show on polls and studies about gun control. We understand, and we don't trust the police generally, and yet and still we understand that gun control will be more valuable for us and our communities and for America than allowing more people to have more gun rights.
Let me go to Clint in Varnville, South Carolina. Clint, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to speak with something that one of the earlier callers was saying about the difference between how white people are perceiving all this and black people. I have the exact same experience here in the rural South. And, I mean, I've been in restaurants where I've heard people working in the restaurants make derogatory comments to the television, seeing Barack Obama on television to the something that I couldn't even repeat or wouldn't want to repeat on the radio, and watched white people in the restaurant laugh and snicker at what he's saying. And for people here in the South to pretend that there isn't this great race divide is just, it's ludicrous. As a white man, seeing this case unfold and knowing emphatically that if Trayvon had been a 17-year-old, like my nephew, white boy, who was killed by a black man, if Zimmerman were black, no doubt about it, he would be in prison. And it's just, it's astonishing to me to see, even as a white man, and it's appalling that this is happening in our country and people are pretending as if it's not.
Clint, we've got you. We've got your witness there. Let me get one more, if I may, and take it to our panel. Knoxville, Tennessee. Clint, thank you. Knoxville, Larry, you're on.
Yes, I just wanted to ask a question. You know, they're all talking about this being a racial profile matter, but yet the boy was in Florida, where it's really hot, wearing a hoodie with dark clothes, and anyone in your neighborhood wearing that kind of, you know, wearing that clothes would definitely look suspicious to anyone. And I just wonder if that's not the issue rather than the fact that he was black. Because if it was white, Mexican, or whatever that was in your neighborhood wearing that kind of clothing, I think that would be suspicious.
Hey, but Larry, you know, Florida in February, not so hot, and it was raining that night. So to have his hood up, is that so weird, Larry?
Yeah, in southern Florida, it's pretty warm in that time, even in February, if you think about it.
Can be, but not necessarily. But anyway, to take your point, Brian, I hear you there.
You know, you're right. It was raining. It was February. And you know, Larry made the comment that if you see someone like that in your neighborhood, well, actually, he was in his neighborhood. His father lived two blocks away.
Yeah.
And that's part of the bias that the president was speaking to, that the default setting in this country, if you know, to say what's normal, what's expected, is in some ways doesn't include young black men. The default setting is white. The default setting is it's not expected to see a young black man with a hoodie on walking in a neighborhood. So you have to assume that something's wrong there.
Well, Brian, just to push it out there, because everybody, you know, George Zimmerman's, his complaint was, we've got a lot of crime in this neighborhood, and I'm fed up with it, and I want to do something about it. I mean,
right, so every black person then is eligible to be seen as a criminal, right? I mean, that was classic victim blaming, right? I mean, that's the same sort of thing we hear in, you know, well, why was she out at night by herself? Why was she wearing
in
that sort
cases,
of a skirt?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, when you listen to that 911 call and you hear that trifecta of stereotypes
thrown at this stranger
in the distance, he's up to no good. He's a criminal. He's on drugs. He's got a gun. I mean, you know, how do you know? Because he's black, and the data just does not bear out young white men who commit crime just as much as black men being followed through the streets for wearing a hoodie or wearing anything else.
I mean, Laura, that is hard to hear. That must go directly to every black parent's fear.
Absolutely. There's a community activist here who developed a little sort of a manual some years ago for parents, things to teach your children, especially your boys, when you're out on the street, how to conduct yourself, what to do when you're stopped by a police officer, what to do when you're accused of a crime, what to do when you're in a volatile, violent situation. We developed over the decades, over a century, coping mechanisms. Chicago is one of the most segregated cities in the nation, and we talk a lot about black crime here. But one of the reasons why there's so much black on black crime, and it's not to excuse this, because African Americans are afraid to move out of their communities. They're afraid to live in integrated communities.
Trapped in the box. Laura Washington, stand by. Brian Monroe, Touré. We're talking about race in America. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the president, the country, and race after Trayvon Martin with Touré of MSNBC, Laura Washington of the Chicago Sun-Times, and Brian Monroe of CNNPolitics.com. Here was Democratic Congresswoman Karen Bass of California on Friday saying that one black president does not erase a history of racial difficulty, but racial progress takes time. This is from CBS affiliate KCAL.
Electing President Obama was a tremendous moment in our history, and it'll always be that. But if anybody thought for 1 minute that that meant, okay, just that one vote, just that one day, now we can erase 400 years of history, I think is very difficult to understand.
And here is that president on Friday in his speech from the briefing room in the White House saying, this is an opportunity to ask ourselves if we really have wrung out our racial bias.
At least you ask yourself your own questions about am I wringing as much bias out of myself as I can? Am I judging people as much as I can based on not the color of their skin, but the content of their character? That would, I think, be an appropriate exercise in the wake of this tragedy.
It's a high bar given our history, but the country has moved a long way toward it. How far? Touré, let me put a couple of our comments from online to you. Jamie says, to deny racial overtones on the part of Florida's legal system is ludicrous. But Ron says, we have an African-American president. That should tell you where we are on race. A sitting president, he goes on to say, a sitting president should not involve himself in a case that's been settled in court. He's responsible for enforcement of laws, not commentary on the outcome of a case. Touré.
Well, I mean, you know, he's not he was very careful at the beginning to show respect to the jury and the rule of law that happened in that case and, you know, to not sort of intervene in that case in a way. But when you have people marching in the streets for days and days and a significant portion of the population, black, white, and Asian and Hispanic, who are in deep pain about this decision, well, then he absolutely has to say something. He can't remain on the sidelines and act like, well, I can't speak about race because I'm black or because it's 2013 or because something. I mean, you know, as the previous person said, you know, the election of Barack Obama did not mean that racial issues are now over. We're in a post-racial America and we have overcome and let's move on to other things. We still have an institutional racism in this country that is settled in, that is going to be stronger than the supposed colorblindness of millennials. You know, we have a prison to we have a project to prison pipeline. We have an education gap. We have a wealth inequality gap at a time when we have the more difficult than any time in the last century to move from in one class to another. Intergenerational mobility has frozen, and that is more penalizing to black people than anyone else. And that is a cause of so many of these problems.
I mean, Brian, you don't hear about a Trayvon Martin case, on the other hand, every day, or maybe they just don't get framed up and publicized in this way every day.
Well, remember, this case was, it took 41 days before there was any arrest here. You know, it took a while between the time he was shot. Remember, he was a John Doe for a while, and it was only community and public outrage that brought this to the attention of the national media. You know, talking about the law and what the president said, you know, I think there's a distinction, and I think many people who were out there protesting made the distinction between what was legal and what was right. There are many things, there are many things that are legal that just aren't right. There are many things that are right that may not be legal, and in this case, It was carving the distinction between the legal issues and the social and societal issues. But one of the callers who talked earlier, I think it was Clint, talked about the comments that he was hearing from his white friends, and they're profound. But as as important as, you know, you look at even out there in the media, Sean Hannity said that he said Obama's comparison, saying he was like Trayvon, was like maybe because he smoked pot and did a little blow. And not, it's Sean Hannity. He says crazy stuff.
Yeah. A denigrating comparison. Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, it's the outrage that people around Sean Hannity, that people around the right didn't come out and say, that's ridiculous. It's disrespectful to say that about any president, any sitting president, whether or not you agree with him or not. 20 years ago, if anyone would have said that, they would have been slapped down by the left or the right, the up and the down. Today, it is accepted. There are not many people, despite the fact that
Saturday Night Live might have done it with George W. Bush and his earlier alcoholism, but you didn't hear it on most mainstream commentary.
And that's part of what has changed in this country and really changed in the last 6 years or so. There is an acceptance of comments and commentary and voices and denigration and disrespect that is just – it's okay now. And that's America's problem.
Tom, you said this doesn't happen all the time, well, perhaps not every single day. But since Trayvon was shot, we had Jordan Davis, also in Florida, shot in a car, supposedly for playing his music too loud. We have this movie about Oscar Grant shot by police in San Francisco while he's in handcuffs. We still had Ayanna Jones, the 9-year-old, I believe, in Detroit, who was shot when on a wrongful no-knock raid by police. So, I mean, these sort of things happen fairly often. And the Malcolm X grassroots movement talks about one black male gets killed every day and a half, every 36 hours, by a police officer, security guard, or a person who is functioning as a security guard.
Yeah, I don't want to be in denial about that. I'm just trying somehow to hold it up against the complexity of our reality, where we've got a lot of African Americans who are, many who aren't, but many who are succeeding these days in all kinds of quite visible ways. I'm not saying it's not all going on at once. It is. That's part of what makes this moment so compelling in our country's history. I mean, Laura, there you are in Chicago. Does it feel like progress but with problems? Or
yes, of course it does. Karen Bass, who we just heard from earlier, who is the congresswoman from California, Southern California, was the first African-American woman to serve as Speaker of the House in California.
Yeah.
So she's one of many examples of progress, political and electoral progress. But I think it also goes back to a frustration that I hear out there around this question of Barack Obama's legitimacy, which you were just speaking of, and the lack of acceptance of him as president. It goes to what the gentleman we were talking about earlier about the comments that are rudely, routinely made about him, the fact that many people really don't accept him as a legitimate president. That's why you get the comment that you got from the person earlier who said, he has no right to speak out. Of course, the President of the United States has a right to speak out and has a responsibility to speak out on these kinds of issues, but there's just this fundamental lack of acceptance of him as our president. And if you have not accepted a black president, where does that leave young black men on the street?
I mean, lack of acceptance in some quarters. Certainly, as a whole, this nation has accepted this president. He's leading, but I hear you, and you can certainly hear that resistance. Bob in Bloomington, Indiana. Bob, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir. What do you hear?
I'm going to start with an overgeneralization, but what I hear from white commentators on the news is that Barack Obama's speech on this issue was rambling, stream of consciousness, and disjointed, and they seem to dismiss it. Yet when I turn on NPR or I listen to black commentators, they talk about how important the speech was and how much it resonated with them and how much we need this at this point in our history. And I wonder if there's a certain just deafness to the idea or topic of racism when it's started by the president.
I mean, when you say you hear white commentators on the news calling this rambling and so on, are you talking the news generally, the evening network news, or are we talking Fox News, Bob?
No, I'm talking generally. I'm talking David Gregory. I'm talking CNN.
Whoa.
I'm not really
Whoa.
just a, I'm not really just a, you know, a basher of Fox News.
Okay, I don't know. We got the point. Yeah, our CNN man is raising his hand.
And the NBC guy has to raise his hand, too. I saw what David Gregory said about it on Meet the Press, and this speech ended about 1:45 at 3 o'clock. I was on MSNBC with a panel of three white guys, and nobody referred to this on MSNBC as rambling or any of those sort of things. I think we all understood this, black and white, as a historic moment, as a very profound speech, and a very intellectually sort of profound and sound moment. I mean, the way this I'm reading the speech again today, mm-hmm. and for something that was done with a minimum of notes, it's fairly extraordinary. And as somebody else said before, threading a needle, nuanced, right? I mean, getting
which I really
most
appreciate,
of the notes
trying
right.
to see where we are and push forward from there, not just, you know, falling all the way back into an ancient argument, though there are ancient issues here, but it's a president who seems to me attuned to this. That we have pushed things forward, but still we got problems. He catches that nuance.
I think there's a little bit more of an ongoing problem because of institutional racism than he's able to admit as the president. If he came down where a black leader who's independent of a white structure would, then he would probably come down a little different. But it would be received a little different. And just to touch back on your issue of, like, yes, there is progress for a small sliver of us, and there are problems for many of us. There's a Chris Rock joke that sort of speaks to some of that. He talks about living in Alpine, New Jersey, alongside, you know, three other black neighbors, you know, a superstar ball player, a superstar singer. Okay. He's a superstar comic. His neighbor is a dentist. You know, he didn't invent any new sort of dental techniques. He's just a dentist. Yeah. And he concludes, you know, like, I had to fly to get to something that the white man could just walk to. And that is so much about what our success is, that we have to be extraordinary, that we have to go to Harvard Law to get to success when, you know, so many white people don't need to do all that. They don't have to fly to get to success.
I hear it.
But I think it's equally important to look at how the president ended his speech. And Ture, you're talking about it earlier. He ended it saying, you know, I don't want us to lose sight of the fact that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. He acknowledges that there is movement. There is motion. Remember, he talked about Malia and Sasha and how their world is a better world, while acknowledging we still have real issues right now.
Some solutions he's looking for here. You know, he's wary of this national conversation on race, kind of ambivalent about that. Why do you think that is, Laura? It's like enough with the talk, or what does that mean?
Because we've had so many of these conversations and even more calls for conversations on race. Whenever there's a fiery, volatile racial issue that comes to the fore, you can go back to O.J. Simpson, you can go back to Rodney King, over and over again, we have conversations and nothing fundamentally changes. And I think he's saying, and I think he said he laid out a number of policy initiatives that he's going to look at, that he's going to study to address things like racial profiling, to address things like gun control, to address some of the inequities in the legal system. And those are real policy initiatives, things, concrete things that we can talk about that can erase some of the inequities in a way that conversation cannot.
Laura Washington with the Chicago Sun-Times. I know you've got to run, Laura. Thank you so much for being with us.
A pleasure, Tom.
Laura Washington in Chicago. Claire in Burlington, Vermont. Claire, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to call in because I've been disheartened listening to people call in and say that Caucasians have been generally less interested, because as a white woman, I recognize that everyone either benefits or is hurt by racism. You know, it's my white privilege that allowed me to grow up in a gated community in Florida, often wearing a hoodie, without any fear that I would ever be misconstrued as a criminal. Or it's my white privilege that statistically says I'll get called back for a job because I have a white-sounding name over a potentially more qualified African-American-sounding name applicant. And the Stand Your Ground law, I believe it says that you don't actually have to be in mortal danger, you have to perceive that you're in mortal danger.
Yep.
So if Caucasians refuse to work toward lessening racism in this country because they think it doesn't affect them, then we will continue to have legal deaths because people will perceive that they're in danger in the presence of a black teenager, regardless of whether or not they're actually dangerous.
Claire, we've got it, and you're switched on, and I appreciate your call. Hey, Brian Ture, let's look at the president says, okay, we've made some progress. Let's make more. Let's not just have a conversation. What looks more important to each of you to try and whatever the downside of this moment is, and it's significant. I hear you, Ture. These dynamics that linger materially. What would you like to see to try and move past this, move on?
I need legislation. I mean, like, just as we saw in the 60s, I need the federal government to move and do things. States' rights, leaving it to the people, is not going to move us forward. There are so many people who are not where the previous caller is, who reject the concept of white privilege, who say, prove it to me, it does not exist. You know, who say things to me like, you know, well, you're more successful than I am, thus that disproves white privilege. I mean, you know, just absurd things. I mean, you know, we just had the Voting Rights Act gutted, which will damage black and brown suffrage going forward. We have, you know, racial profiling, which is legal in terms of SB 1070 and other places where it's not explicitly banned. We have Stand Your Ground, which works in practice to allow more black and brown people to be shot and found justified in being shot. We have things that we need relief from that the federal government can try to save us from.
Brian, what would you like to see? The president said he asked Americans to ask themselves if they're wringing as much bias out of their minds as they can. Okay, there's a step. That's always a worthy exercise. What else?
Well, one thing that may be coming out of this is a more targeted, focused activism, particularly in the African-American community. We saw how, while there were calls for boycotting Florida, the National Association of Black Journalists is having their convention there and next week, whether or not that will really do anything. But you are seeing people like Stevie Wonder and other entertainers who have come out and said they won't perform there. But a lot of activity, particularly around African-American social groups, is focused on changing laws, is focused on amending Stand Your Ground, whether it's Florida or Arizona or many other states across the country that have these, and actually getting something done. And that's, I think, we may see a new flavor of activism come out of this.
You know,
Tom, can I ask Brian a question quickly?
'Cause
you were the head of the NABJ, right?
Mm-hmm.
National Association of Black Journalists.
Yeah. Yes.
Right. So if you were still the head of NABJ now, would you move the convention out of Orlando?
Well, the current president, Greg Lee, has released a comment on that. But if I was president, I would not. And one, because
you would not what, to be clear?
I would not move the convention out of Florida. It's literally next week. It starts July 31st, goes through August 4th in Orlando. Because one, it'll cost the organization $1 million of real money right now.
Yeah.
And second of all, it may not have as much effect as it would if you had some national panels and conversations, which they are doing, on this very topic to raise awareness and actually try to get more people engaged in the topic.
That's what we
have to do as journalists.
Yeah, stand up and talk about it. I mean, Turi, it is interesting. This is not a Rodney King response. There's lots of protests, but this isn't riots.
I never expected riots. We're not an inherently violent people.
Not saying that. Maybe, though, we're at a different moment here. People hoping that we can talk to a solution. People in the streets in a lot of cities asking very loudly for that. Very grateful to the two of you for being with us. Touré with MSNBC's The Cycle.
Tom.
Thanks for joining us from New York. Brian Monroe with CNNPolitics.com. Thank you, as always, Brian.
Thanks a lot, Tom and Touré.
And listeners, thanks for your calls. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.